Good evening, and welcome to another episode of Read Me Something You Love. And this evening, I'm here in South London, in the cosily cluttered, or cluttedly cosy. What? Do you mind your abode being called cosily cluttered or cluttedly cosy?
I can cope.
I'm here with the poet and social worker Rogan Wolf, who has very kindly offered for me to come and join him, and fed me a whole array of delicious things, and we've been recording some of your poetry.
Yes, it's been wonderful.
It has been wonderful. It's been like a poetry reading for one, you know, sort of the most bijou of poetry readings. Very special. Now, I know you, Rogan, mainly through your website and also through this incredible Poems for initiative that you've been working on for a number of years, and have done the occasional event connected with that. Could you maybe explain a little bit more about that for people who haven't heard of it or heard about it?
The project has been going for 10 years, as you say. It's quite a few years. It has evolved, but essentially it offers poems for display, nowadays for downloading, for display, in public places where, of course, poetry does not usually go to public places. It usually goes into private heads. Here, it's small posters that I think belong nowadays. Actually, they do belong mostly in classrooms. But originally, we aimed for waiting rooms, which can be desolate places of tension and long pause, often very long. How do you fill that space? Well, a poem that is actually quite an intimate connection might help. And you never know, but it's a sounder even place than a railway carriage, Poems on the Underground. The poems are carefully selected. I take great care with that and I get good advice on it. Nowadays, it's a very wide selection indeed. And a few years ago, we went down the path of bilingual poems, because in waiting rooms, first off, but in schools even more off, people of all languages, of all mother tongues, sit there together in the same situation of fragility. So there are 50 languages represented so far in this selection that we have. Over 200 poems now available.
Do you know offhand how many doctors' waiting rooms, for example, these beautiful posters, and they are beautifully produced as well. How many of these actually are hanging in doctors' waiting rooms?
I can't confidently tell you anymore. I know how many have gone out. I can't tell you straight off the top of my head. But we're talking thousands, Steve, and all over the country. I've learned about places of this country that I've never heard of before through just picking up and catching up with how many people have asked for them, where they've gone to.
Why? I'm just wondering, Rogan, for someone who is as steeped in poetry as you are, I was really, really interested when you told me your two potential choices for this, and one was the passage from Corinthians, and the other is this meditation. And I thought, this is really, really interesting that you have chosen essentially two pieces of prose that are very poetic, but you haven't actually chosen... You're a poet who hasn't chosen poetry.
Well, you did say that you wanted prose, actually.
Did I?
Okay. Yes, yes.
Sorry.
That's my first offence. Well, I have been through some funerals recently. This piece that I'm going to read wasn't read at a funeral, but I've always adored it. I suppose I love his mind, John Donne's incredibly excited mind as it whizzes into huge, deep areas and then rushes off and zooms off into another area. I just love following it. I just love the sound of the following of it. And that the climactic part of this famous passage is often taken out of context, because the context is almost as fine as that climax is. The image of connection is something that drives me, and how one makes the connection, how one feels it. We live so much in the sense or delusion of lack of it, that here is perhaps the greatest articulation of all, I think, of the truth of our situation. I don't think it needs him to be ill or him to be dying for these words to carry this enormous weight. I don't follow his religion. I am not of his religion. Both these pieces that I've selected are religious, I suppose, Christian pieces. And I adore them without necessarily having that faith at all, which I don't. I simply don't.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, and maybe that's something we can talk about further. But shall we maybe read first?
Yes, I'd love to, yeah. So this is Meditation 17, and it comes from a longer collection of his thoughts called Devotions Upon Emergent Occasions, which were written after he had been very ill and often thinking he was about to die. There's a Latin subheading, which I think is then translated into English. Nunc lento sonitu dicunt morieris. Now this bell tolling softly for another says to me, thou must die. Perchance he for whom this bell tolls may be so ill as that he knows not it tolls for him. And perchance I may think myself so much better than I am, as that they who are about me and see my state may have caused it to toll for me, and I know not that. The Church is Catholic, universal, so are all her actions, all that she does belongs to all. When she baptizes a child, that action concerns me, for that child is thereby connected to that head, which is my head too, and engrafted into the body whereof I am a member. And when she buries a man, that action concerns me. All mankind is of one author and is one volume. And when one man dies, one chapter is not torn out of the book, but translated into a better language. And every chapter must be so translated. God employs several translators. Some pieces are translated by age, some by sickness, some by war, some by justice. But God's hand is in every translation, and his hand shall bind us all our scattered leaves again for that library where every book shall lie open to one another. As therefore the bell that rings a sermon calls not upon the preacher only, but upon the congregation to come, so this bell calls us all, but how much more me, who am brought so near the door by this sickness.
So you were saying beforehand that the last couple of months have been a number of funerals in your life. A piece like this, how does that speak to you when you do have a lot of death around you?
I can't say anything too literal. I mean, he done at the end of this passage takes what for me can't be much comfort. I can't take the same comfort as he does from this talk of affliction. I can take some of it, and I can agree with some of it, but not quite to the end he took it to. I find, though, him tackling a subject which I've lived quite vividly recently with such glorious dignity and sonorousness and aliveness. And I know the story of his death. I don't know if you know it. And he gloried almost into the last minute of his life, the experience of dying. And he had his portrait taken in his winding sheet while he was very ill, partly to prepare himself, I assume, but saying, here am I, I'm dying, and I'm still here. And isn't this of interest, equal interest to some time when I was chasing ladies down the corridor when I was young? I suppose it's the beauty of the language that makes the experience more bearable, and the rhythm and the sparkle of the brain as he explores all these thoughts. I've already thought to myself, I would like to go out with as much panache as he went. And this shows some panache, I'd have thought. It's more glorious prose virtually than any other prose I've ever heard. That's not bad for someone who's very ill. And so he spoke in that language, holding his dignity.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's maybe return to a little bit more closely to some of the prose, because there's certain parts here that I sort of think I know what he's saying, yeah. But I'm not really that sure, so I'm interested in asking you about those.
Well, I may not give you an expert answer, Stephen.
No, I'm not expecting an expert answer, but I'm hoping that maybe as someone who is slightly closer to this and has read it more times than I'm sure I have, maybe has a better sense of it. I try to begin with, kind of almost situate myself and situate the speaker. And I imagine a man kind of rolling around on his sick bed and actually possibly even hearing the church bells.
I would have thought so, yes.
Through the window.
Yeah.
And suddenly hearing them anew. And it sort of got me thinking about how we hear messages or sounds that were not necessarily meant for us. They suddenly become very, very personal.
Yes. There was a small procession, wasn't there, of the priest going, ringing his bell, handbell, towards the person who was dying.
If that's the case, then, and if you're that dying man, then there must be that moment when you think, yes, oh, this really is it.
This is me.
Because this is, yes, that bell is hunting you down.
Yes.
It's well, like, people it's were like better the angel at that, of then. Death almost, yes, coming a calling and knocking on your door.
Yes. We're now on drugs when we die, yes, let's face it. Yeah. But here people were not, and a priest came and said, you're dying, get ready. That was a different kind of moment.
And I wonder if that, just what you said there, that, you know, we're on drugs when we die, and yet somebody comes to you at the height of your suffering, in John Donne's day, and says, you are dying. It made me think of this line where, talking about the library, where every book shall lie open to one another, and I was thinking,
that's a wonderful image.
What is he trying to convey with that?
But I think that library is, of course, eternal life, heaven or hell. And in that library, there are no secrets. Therefore, everything you've ever done, everything you've ever thought, is now open to be judged. And that's the part terror, as well as the comfort of communication and openness. I just love the idea, not the theology, because I can't go with it, but the idea of being translated by these various things that kill people, yeah, it's just brilliant.
It's interesting you read judgment into that, and I'm sure maybe Donne would have read judgment.
I think, well, that's right. I think that's where I'm coming from, because he was terrified of judgment.
Whereas I don't see any judgment at all. I see it more as this sort of,
yes,
almost a kind of like a sort of idealistic hippie vision.
Yes,
well, everybody almost stoned in a way, and suddenly able to, you know, all the niceties dropping away, and everyone being able to talk and communicate freely.
Well, that's a very nice image.
whereas you see it more as a sort of a reckoning.
There are no secrets, yes, and that surely can also be extremely frightening.
Do you think you would be terrified to be in this state of every book lying open to one another, knowing that all the other books were in and of themselves also open to you?
Well, it's not instantly particularly comfortable thought, no. Not your hippie Nirvana. It's a fascinating thought, though. In some ways, it's what we all perhaps yearn for at the same time. Just not to have secrets.
I think it is. That is, yeah. That surely that is intimacy. And that is to...
Oh, well, yes. But that, to have choice over whether you keep them or not seems important. And here there is no choice. I love that shorter paragraph that ends the passage that I just read there, that earlier, the first part of the piece. I don't know. Why do I love it? It just brings it to him in his vulnerability and just makes him associate with it. And I find it touchingly personal, at the same time humble. Mm. And I don't know, it's just a complex of feelings. And the argument about being... lying open to one another is, for me, a bit theological, and I can go abstract. But here, suddenly, in this last little paragraph, it stops being that, for me. Another man may be sick, too, and sick to death, and this affliction may lie in his bowels as gold in a mine, and be of no use to him. But this bell that tells me of his affliction digs out and applies that gold to me, if by this consideration of another's dangers I take mine own into contemplation, and so secure myself by making my recourse to my God, who is our only security.
Shall we read the next part?
There was a contention as far as a suit, in which piety and dignity, religion and estimation were mingled, which of the religious orders should ring to prayers first in the morning, and it was determined that they should ring first that rose earliest. If we understand aright the dignity of this bell that tolls for our evening prayer, we would be glad to make it ours by rising early, in that application, that it might be ours as well as his, whose indeed it is. The bell doth toll for him that thinks it doth, and though it intermit again, yet from that minute that occasion wrought upon him, he is united to God. Who casts not up his eye to the sun when it rises, but who takes off his eye from a comet when that breaks out? Who bends not his ear to any bell which upon any occasion rings, but who can remove it from that bell which is passing a piece of himself out of this world?
Who can remove it from that bell which is passing a piece of himself out of this world?
Yes, well, that's the climax, surely. The best I can do with this is that the bell reminds you of reality, reminds you of where you are, and therefore is useful to you. So hear it, and that brings us to God. And just as you can't ignore that moment when the bell is tolling, neither can you ignore the sun, God himself, the comet, God himself. These are the great realities which perhaps we spend much of our lives not living with or in apprehension of.
So that moment of mindfulness, that moment of knowing this is it, whatever the it is, through your reading and perhaps through my agnostic, even atheist reading, that is God at some level. That is as close to God as we're going to get.
Perhaps, yeah. And I think it's saying, perhaps, that the moments he's passing through, this man who's very ill and could be dying or could have been dying, is therefore in a privileged position.
Privileged position.
Because closer to truth, yeah. It's not a thought many of us would choose to have, but you could see how he gets there.
Could you read for us the last part?
No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if promontory were, as well as if a manor of thy friends or of thine own were. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind, and therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. Neither can we call this a begging of misery, or a borrowing of misery, as though we are not miserable enough of ourselves, but must fetch in more from the next house, in taking upon us the misery of our neighbours. Truly, it were an excusable covetousness if we did, for affliction is a treasure, and scarce any man hath enough of it. No man hath affliction enough that is not matured and ripened by it, and made fit for God by that affliction. If a man carry treasure in bullion, or in a wedge of gold, and have none coined into current monies, his treasure will not defray him as he travels. Tribulation is treasure in the nature of it, but it is not current money in the use of it, except we get nearer and nearer our home, heaven, by it. Another man may be sick too, and sick to death, and this affliction may lie in his bowels as gold in a mine, and be of no use to him, but this bell that tells me of his affliction digs out and applies that gold to me, if by this consideration of another's dangers I take mine own into contemplation, and so secure myself by making my recourse to my God, who is our only security.
Thank you.
It's making you love cats all the more.
Your cat's got character, I like that.
This one has.
So you have this great line, neither can we call this a begging of misery or a borrowing of misery, and we were talking a little bit before we start reading, I suppose, about being morbid, writing morbid poetry. Your poetry certainly doesn't shy away from the big themes. Is the suggestion here of what might be the difference between empathy, so empathy for oneself and one's own suffering, and for the suffering of others, and just sort of wallowing in one's own misery and in the misery of others?
I don't find it easy to follow Dunn in this last passage, I have to say. But I think, for me, it comes slightly clearer only at the end, because this thing about the more misery we have, the luckier we are, so almost it is a good thing for us, is difficult to go with, except insofar as it can prepare us for the ultimate. And I can only think that's what he's saying, that the place we need to be is in total openness and readiness for the ultimate. And he's suggesting that these afflictions and empathy with others who are can help us get there. Do I agree with him? I'm not sure. I probably don't. Some of me agrees partly, maybe.
And what is that readiness?
Well, although I'm not religious, I do keep befriending and having important moments with people who are. And I remember way back, someone was saying, where's the effect of, it is the same thing to be open to being alive, to being open to the living moment. That process is the perfect preparation for being open to the final surrender, which is death. And one is not the end of another. It is the same thing. It is just surrender and being open, letting go. The more alive you are, the ready you are to die, or the less you distinguish between the two, is the understanding I took from it. Now, this done a few centuries ago, has a darker take on that same idea, I think. It's a similar idea, but almost a glorying in the pain, in that it gets you readier for the ultimate. Is everything else just an escape from reality? It's pretty harsh. He never sounds harsh, though, himself. He's always passionately engaged. So it never feels as dour as some of the meanings seem to be. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if promontory were, as well as if a manor of thy friends or of thine own were. I would say the social worker bit would say that the more we exclude, the more we are excluding of ourselves. The need to exclude is something pathological in ourselves, and fears that we have, parts of ourselves we don't want to look at. And the more we can make contact with that which is difficult to make contact with, so the stronger we are. And although that may seem very social worky and difficult to actually imagine and practice, economists say, for instance, the more inequality you have, actually the weaker the economy is.
And you find that here, don't you? If a clod be washed away by the sea,
yes,
we are the less for it.
Yes.
So we don't perhaps value the clod, but as part of us, as part of the whole.
Yes, it is inescapably part of who we are. It is, in that sense, very contemporary, this passage.
And is it because, does some of that depth also come from the fact that it is, as he admits, very personal? This is not a sermon. This is a man who is sick, who, and you know, we all know what it's like when you sort of enter the world of the sick. You suddenly realize that they're it's quite a different world from, you know, you sort of look out of your window and you see the world you've just come from, and you're now in the world of the sick. It's a man who is writing from that place, as opposed to writing to that place.
I think, though, this is crude, but if someone now had written this, someone had had the idea, I'm going to write about my illness, it would have come as far more autobiographical and me than he has done it. Because he's, the base his writing from is looking at him almost from a distance of his theological position here, and his intention to use this thing to teach. So that he is almost just part of the landscape himself. So he's looking at himself in his sick bed as part of his trying to understand it. But also, there is an audience there, isn't there? He's talking to others, even while he's in danger of death and very close to it.
Does that not distance him in some way from
the audience? Well, for me, it does not, because of, I don't know, the poise, the slight detachment that it gives him, I think, adds to its strength. You know, we've heard enough, haven't we? We hear plenty. I do it quite a lot myself, of saying from one's own subjectivity, as if that's the whole world. Whereas for him, his subjectivity is just part of what can be learnt from this. He's almost looking at himself with fascination, rather than total self-absorption. And in a way, I think that's more interesting.
Well, thank you so much for letting me filter some John Donne through your subjectivity this evening. It's been illuminating.
Well, I hope so.
In every way. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.